So I'm going to talk a little bit about microbial population genetics. So first of all, thanks, Marty and Massimo, for inviting me here. It's been beautiful so far. My interests, in fact, my most contemporary interests overlap quite a lot with what was discussed in the last few weeks, that is, the dynamics of selection in the context of linked sites that are either fully or partly linked, and which I think is a huge open problem, to be honest. Nonetheless, what I'm going to talk about today are much more simple things having to do with the dynamics at individual sites that are either freely recombining with every other site, or we might just imagine we have just two genetic variants in a population. So very classical questions about single site population genetics, but in the context of microbial populations. So I really have two things I wanted to discuss, possibly with coffee in between, depending upon how long some things take. Both of them are relevant to microbes, but the first of these two things is, I think, a much more practical issue that arises when we actually look at sequence data sampled from microbial populations. And the second thing here is less practical, maybe a little bit more philosophical. A question about what it really means to have neutrality in the context of a microbial population. It was mentioned, I heard it on a video of one of their talks the last few weeks, that there's only one type of neutrality, which is what makes neutrality so easy to model. I think it was mentioned by Bob Griffiths. I'm not really one to disagree with him on neutrality, but I will nonetheless. I think there are probably many types of neutrality, and a few of them I want to discuss in the second part of the talk here. Anyways, but on with this practical first issue about DNDS. I want to talk about DNDS and its interpretation and what it does or doesn't tell us about selection pressures in the context of samples from a microbial population. And so in the end, this works out to talking about the population genetics of DNDS as opposed to the sort of long timescale evolutionary genetics of DNDS. So before I even, well, first of all, this work on DNDS is all in close collaboration with a postdoc of mine, Sergei Krudminsky. He's with me at Penn. And before I even discuss DNDS, and these two slides might be superfluous given how many population geneticists are actually here, but might be useful for the odd physicist who decided to come to today's talks. I just want to distinguish between two very different timescales in evolutionary processes that are important to distinguish in the context of microbial populations in particular. And one of those timescales is what I'm going to call evolutionary timescales or long timescales. And these are the timescales that usually separate the divergence of entirely different species. And for our purposes, these are timescales that are much greater than n generations, where n is the population size of any one of these species. So this is longer evolutionary time to me. And it stands in contrast to what I would call short timescales or population genetic timescales that are of the order of n generations, where n is the population size of any one of these species. And these are the timescales that correspond to the coalescent events between samples from a single species, sample from a single population, as it were. And these are, of course, the timescales that are relevant to most of population genetics per se, whereas long timescales are really relevant to evolutionary theory. So this distinction, as you'll see in a second, becomes extremely important in the context of microbial DNDS values. So again, these might be superfluous for some people who really are practicing population geneticists, but I want to just briefly review this statistic, DNDS, that's commonly used to quantify selection pressures, either positive or negative, on a protein coding region. And it was introduced, it may have been discussed in some sense earlier than this, but in some sense it was introduced in a particular formalism in the 90s, and it was explicitly introduced in the context of these long timescale discussions. This is sort of the picture. In fact, this is actually the first application of this particular method to a globin gene that had been sequenced. There was sort of one stereotypical and representative sequence for each of these various divergent primate species. And these individual sequences that had been diverged a long time in the past were being compared. And the idea, of course, was to align these protein coding regions and to more or less just count the number of non-silent substitutions that have occurred in this alignment and the number of silent substitutions that have occurred. And of course, you actually have to normalize these counts by the number of such sites that that exist in the sequence. And moreover, you don't actually just count them. You might actually apply some maximum likelihood framework that infers how many substitutions actually occurred, accounting for possible multiple mutations or multiple substitutions at a site. But the basic idea is this. You count how many non-silent and silent substitutions there are. You take their ratio, and presuming, and this has been discussed quite a lot in the last few weeks, whether or not this is good, but presuming for the time being that these silent substitutions are neutral, when this ratio is less than 1, it's interpreted as evidence that the protein is evolving under negative selection. That is, most of the pressure constrains changes at the amino acid level more than neutral changes occur. Whereas if this ratio is greater than 1, then a protein is typically interpreted to be evolving under positive selection, adaptive pressure that promotes amino acid changes in the sequence over long time scales. And of course, again, in practice, there's a maximum likelihood framework for both estimating this ratio from an alignment and assessing the significance of the departure of your estimate from 1. So you can assign some p-value to whether or not the NDS is significantly greater than 1, significantly less than 1.
This would most likely miss most of positive selection.
Well, right. So first, yeah, there's a lot of issues here. And one of the first ones is that if, in fact, most of the sites in the protein coding region are either neutral or negative, and only a few of them are positive, then this will, as you say, most likely miss. It will not infer that that protein is under positive selection, but so few of its sites are. So one of the strict assumptions here is that at least initially, every protein coding site is experiencing the same gamma. And you're sort of getting a most likely estimate of that one gamma. So that's an initial, very strong criticism. That can be relaxed pretty easily, of course, by assuming a distribution of selection pressures across sites and doing maximum likelihood estimation of that distribution, as it were. That's not actually the issue I'm going to talk about, though.
Well, while we're just talking about these general issues, it hasn't really come up explicitly yet in this whole meeting, and that is, and maybe almost everyone knows this, we always start out with, we align these sequences, and then we're going to estimate something from them, and since you're specifically talking about this in a phylogenetic context, the alignment of sequences always presuppose phylogeny.
Right.
Because the general multi-taxon alignment problem is essentially impossible. And so the shortcut that all the standard methods use is to try to initially estimate or you supply a phylogeny. So at the end of the day, you hope that that bias doesn't affect your actual calculations, but there's absolutely some circularity in this. And I only mention it because there's some really bold physicists in the room amongst them. Revisit that whole literature on the alignment problem. There's still something to be looking at.
Right. Actually, it turns out that although it's never actually done in practice, this initial paper from 1994 discusses simultaneously a way to deduce the phylogeny of the sequences being compared and to simultaneously infer the DNDS ratio, as it were. There's sort of a maximum likelihood framework for both the phylogeny and this parameter. In practice, as you say, people first align it with some other method. First both infer the alignment and the phylogeny with some other very different method, maybe a parsimony method, and then they apply a maximum likelihood way to estimate the NDS. But again, I'm not even discussing that technical problem at all.
Okay. There are some alignment methods that actually try to do these two things at once.
And right.
There's some sort of, Monte Carlo Markov chain where you can, redo parts of the phylogeny and realign and sort of iterate all these things. But at the end of the day, I don't think these things typically work a lot better than standard methods.
It's quite rare that the biologists don't retouch the alignment at the end. They usually don't like what they find. And so they use their knowledge to it's rare to see this statistics procedure, which is applied to the end in a straightforward alignment. It's really hard problem.
It would be overly generous to say they use their knowledge to reject.
Yes, that's right. So they, but that really messes up the statistics, because when you're trying to test something and you ask, well, did you retouch this? And they do. It's like taking out outliers. So you reduce the noise.
The problem is, when, you know, when there's insertion deletion, when gaps are being introduced into sequences to have an alignment, there's some decision making that has to be made, programmed to make this right, about whether to introduce a gap, whether to extend the gap, and whether to close the gap. And those parameters are just pulled out of the hat. There's no real biological basis for them. And so when you know, the typical biologist goes back in and readjusts those things, you know, this is a part of the discussion, perhaps there's some legitimacy, because there was no legitimacy in the first place for, you know, why those were introduced, where they were in the first place. They were done in a consistent way, you could say that across the team. Not to good effect, or uniformly good effect.
And maybe it's, as I said, this is most severe in regulatory regions where you don't have the regularity of a protein, and then these errors in gap translate, can very easily translate into an excess of presumed point substitution, and so then your selection is measured on those.
In any case, I think these are all actually very real issues. But I'm going to nevertheless address a problem where we assume we know perfectly the alignment and the tree. In fact, the tree will be very simple. Just have two taxa in the discussion I'm going to present. And nevertheless, I think that the issue I'm going to be presenting is, in some sense, maybe possibly far more severe than any issue that could arise from alignment or misalignment. Okay, so first of all, this framework of aligning things and counting numbers of aligning divergent things and counting numbers of non-silent and silent substitutions, appropriately counting them and taking the ratios, has proven extremely popular. I think it's in some sense the simplest and most readily applied basic statistic to detect evolutionary constraints or adaptation around. It doesn't involve any population genetic data per se, and so there's really thousands of proteins that have been deduced to be under positive or negative selection on the basis of this test. One really beautiful example is the sperm lysine gene in abalone, for which we have, I guess, lots of data. And not only can you deduce, and this gets to your question, Mike, that the proteins under positive selection, but you can get a posteriori, you can get posterior probabilities for each individual site having omega or DNDS bigger than one. So you can get really pretty refined information if you have a lot of data. Okay, so now I want to change the medium to the board for a little while and discuss the theory of how DNDS works and how it works or doesn't work in the context of microbes. So first of all, we have this notion that when DNDS is greater than 1, we have positive selection, and less than 1, we have negative selection. Let's just revisit where that notion came from. This was, I think, really first written down by Nielsen and Yang in that paper in 2003, although I'm sure a lot of people had this in the back of their mind. And the idea is people thought about two sort of very divergent species or populations. That again, this is over evolutionary timescales, where these are divergence much greater than n generations. And the idea is that mutations will arise at rate mu n. Let's just say they both have the same population size for now. And they will fix with probability 1 on n if it's a silent and presumably neutral site, or I should say a presumed neutral site, and 2s, 1 minus even minus ns, I'm thinking about haploid populations here, if it's a amino acid encoding site. And this implies, of course, that the expected DNDS ratio is just the ratio of these fixation probabilities, which works out to gamma over 1 minus e to the minus 2 gamma, where gamma is just a scaled selection coefficient. So I'm going to talk about the assumptions underlying this derivation in just a second. But this equation that relates the expected DNDS ratio to the underlying selection coefficient is an important link. And it, I think, is what provides us the intuition that when gamma's bigger than 0, we get DNDS bigger than 1. So just to give you a feeling for scale here, if I were to plot gamma, and the numbers here sort of matter a little bit, compared to the expected DNDS ratio under this simple model. This is about minus 4, minus 8, 4 and 8. It looks something like this. In other words, when gamma is 0, the expected DNDS ratio really is 1. I'm not sure if I've drawn it quite properly. But the critical thing here is that as soon...
I'm trying to understand the formula. The negative gamma, that ratio would be negative according to the formula.
Something is not really right here.
Do I have it?
The ratio is still.
Yeah, the right.
Oh, sorry.
The numerator would be negative. Right, this is just the ratio of fixation properties given that we've normalized by so the number of sites are the same as the sound. Okay, so this is actually a graph of that function there. And a few things to note, I didn't draw it perfectly here. When gamma is 0, the NDS is 1. But as soon as gamma becomes on the order of, say, minus 4, which is, I guess, still strictly speaking in the realm of weak selection, because this is the scaled selection coefficient, but this is what I would consider moderate selection, the NDS ratio is expected to be almost 0. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. As soon as you have really just moderate negative selection, the NDS is expected to be 0. But moreover, as gamma becomes positive, the NDS really, really increases very quickly beyond 1. This is like 3 when gamma is just positive 1 or so. Okay, so this is the classical picture over long time scales. And let me just mention the assumptions that underlie this derivation. And they're really worth pondering over for a few seconds. So first of all, the first critical assumption is that we assumed we had independent populations. And that goes into this from the very beginning. The origin and subsequent fixation of mutations in one population is completely independent from what's happening in this second population from which you're going to compare these two sequences. That's actually the critical thing I want to notice. There are a few other things that are interesting here. First of all, we have, in this discussion here, we have what I would call instantaneous fixation events. In the sense that, and this is, I think, a completely reasonable assumption or approximation over these long timescales, when one mutation arises in one of these populations, it essentially fixes instantaneously in the sense that no other mutations are allowed to arise at that site before that first mutation has either fixed or gone extinct. Okay, so this you might consider this as saying that the theta per site is much less than 1, so that typically at every site, each of these populations is monomorphic. Mutations come in and either fix or go extinct long before another mutation arises at that site. The third assumption that was made here is that there are independent sites, or, in other words, free recombination. So the process of origin and fixation of mutations at silent sites is, in this case, completely independent from the origin and fixation at selected sites right next door. And this is, of course, not a very good assumption, although it's interesting, it won't actually bias our estimates of DNDS, but it will change their variances. And it's maybe not a terrible assumption if selection is weak. And it takes, in some sense, a long time for these things to fix. And in between that time, some recombination can break up things. But I'm not going to relax this independent of types assumption today at all. That's not really the thing I want to talk about. The fourth assumption here that is something that's worth pondering again has to do with the model of selection. The model of selection is what I'm going to call continual selection. In the sense that every protein coding site, at least initially, is assumed to have the same selection pressure on it, S. In the sense that when a mutation arises at a protein coding site, it experiences selective advantage S compared to the resident type. And that statement is always true. And so in particular, if you're at a site and a mutation arises that is positively selected and it fixes, a subsequent mutation at that site is also then positively selected over the resident type, including the reversion, which is actually a little bit funny if you think about it. You're at a site, you're positively selected for a change. As soon as it fixes, if you happen to acquire a mutation to the thing that you started with, it is also positively selected back. Right? That's the model of selection that's going in here, this continual model that no matter what the resident type is, a mutant is always experiencing the same selection pressure relative to it. Is that clear to everyone?
Another way of saying it. I can see this makes sense if you talk about infinite size model. Because then everything is independent.
Right.
And you might make this uniformity assumption, although even there it's an additional assumption. As soon as you talk about back mutation, then assumption doesn't really make sense.
If you have an infinite size model, then this last point about the selection model is less of an issue. Right, because mutations will always arise at new sites. But I want to emphasize here is that if you in fact have a finite number of sites, as you really do in reality for most genes and for all genes, the assumption, the way in which selection has been treated, and the way in which this relationship holds, implies that back mutations are positively selected, just as the forward mutation was.
It's only reasonable to assume that forward selection is S and backward selection is minus S.
Right, but that's not what is assumed here. And so I'll make this more clear in a second, where I'll show you a simulation and an analysis where if you make the assumption that new mutations always have experience S, then you get precisely this relationship.
It's sort of like a limit of assuming that you only get 0 or 1 substitutions at each site. Isn't that
over all time?
Well, it wouldn't solve the problem, right? You can still. The question is, are reversions common enough to be a problem? And you would imagine that this model only makes sense to the extent that there aren't, which is what Mike was saying. I mean, are you saying anything other than that?
No, I'm not saying.
I think he's defending this assumption. It's just that's just the assumption of the way it's being treated.
Yeah. So if you have
assumption is infinite site model.
Yeah. So I think that these are really equivalent things. We could say this is under the infinite site model, and the selection pressure is always gamma. When a mutation arises, it's always at a new site. And if that's all you want that's the way you want to phrase it, then that's fine. I just want to point out, though, that in practice, and this happens all the time in microbial situations, as I'm going to discuss in a second, you get, over the timescales that are just being discussed, many reversions. It only really, this model, this calculation only makes sense if you assume that, again, every mutation that arises at a site has the same selection pressure over the resident as any other mutation.
But there's still two independent assumptions. So one is independence of the selection coefficient of subsequent mutation. That's automatically the infinite size model. And the second is equality of all these coefficients. These are two independent assumptions. Could be independent and drawn from a distribution.
Oh, yes, that's fine, too. Oh, yes, you're right. We could replace this last thing with, in a finite site model, you draw from a distribution, but you draw from the same distribution independently, regardless of whether or not it's a reversion or not. Yeah.
And I would say, in defense of your concern about this, the practicality, like the way these methods work, they look on a phylogeny at a particular codon, and they claim that there's positive selection there. They see that site substituting too many times.
Right.
Phylogeny.
That's actually the primary evidence. Yeah.
And, so it's not as, now they're not necessarily occurring on the same lineage, but also direct, and then these are kind of different lineage. But it's not that the sites aren't substituting multiple times in the data, they are. That's in fact the evidence for selection.
Okay, so let's return now to the other medium. So DNDS, although originally developed over these kinds of timescales, is now actually quite commonly applied to microbes. And people more or less replace this figure here with this figure, where instead of a really long timescale tree, they sort of replace it with a coalescent tree of the relationships between many samples from essentially one population. Here's many samples from a tuberculosis population, from a population of TB. Some of these are from the same patient even. And once you build a tree like this, you can, of course, immediately apply all of the machinery of DNDS. And this is now typically done. And when it's done, a whole range of actually really interesting conclusions are reached. So it's been applied to a whole range of organisms in this setting. That's to say, many samples from a single population, build a tree, align the genes, and calculate the DNDS statistic and interpret it. So one very recent study, this is actually a fascinating study. These people sequenced, they sequenced 19 full genomes of typhoid, and they, for each protein, aligned them and calculated DNDS. And the central conclusion, which was a bit surprising, is that although they did a whole range of other things in looking at population structure, one of the conclusion about adaptation is that time and again they would find that the DNDS value of the aligned of the alignment was near one, and as a result, they found very little evidence for adaptive pressure across the whole typhoid genome. And in fact, they found little pressure either for positive or negative selection across the typhoid genome. And their interpretation here was that somehow the effective population size of typhoid is very small, so that these gammas, which go into this expression, are all near zero. So, but the same kind of technique has been applied to a whole range of microbial samples, and sort of more interesting phenomenon have been observed. So one thing that happens that's been observed time and again in different systems is that when comparing very closely related samples, such as viral samples from a single infected patient, when comparing the sequences of a protein from such samples, the DNDS values are very near one. Whereas when comparing samples from much more divergent populations, DNDS will be farther from one. So this is a case of a protein under negative selection, at least over long timescales, as it were. And then here again in mitochondria, it's been discussed that DNDS is typically not that extreme when comparing mitochondria from one human to another, whereas the mitochondria from human to chimps show a very strong signature, in this case of negative selection. And the same kind of thing has been observed in viral sequences, where more recent comparisons or more proximal comparisons find DNDS values near one, whereas more distant comparisons find signatures of selection. And this happens again in flu. This is actually an interesting situation. In flu, there's a sort of time series. We have these sequences, flu sequences come around every few seasons, and comparisons of flu sequences, even in proteins that are really known in some sense to be undergoing adaptive change, like the surface proteins, comparisons of such sequences from within one season, again, typically find DNDS near one. There's no signature of adaptation, whereas between seasons, they find DNDS values that are far in excess of one, showing in some sense that over long time scales, there is pressure for change. And the interpretation in this case was that there's changing selection pressure. So at times, at different times, there's pressure for change, and then in between these epochs, there's sort of no pressure for change. There have been a whole lot of other explanations for these patterns having to do with fluctuating population sizes or the existence of a separate set of sites that are sort of weakly deleterious, which segregate within a population but not between populations and so on. So, but anyways, it's against the backdrop of these sort of observations in microbial samples that I want to discuss the DNDS statistic within a population. Do you have a question?
Okay, I think maybe you're going to start talking about within a population.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you're already sort of seeing that the issue here is that the interpretation of DNDS that I just presented relied very critically on the fact that the sequences being compared were from divergent and independent populations for a long time. And it's simply not appropriate to use the exact same interpretation of DNDS when comparing sequences that are garnished from one population. And so that begs the question, well, what is the behavior of this statistic for sequences that have been sampled from a single population? So that's what I want to discuss right now. Again, turning to the blackboard. So,
what you're saying is that if you take the NDS from many, many pairs of individuals that are just daughters, right, or sisters,
yeah,
then you're just looking at mutation rate because selection has absolutely no time to act, and therefore you're gonna see mutations equally often in coding changes as synonymous changes.
So you're suggesting that within a population, DNDS will always be exactly one or something?
Well, if you go to things that are intimately close, right? Let's say sister.
Well, the question I want to ask is, in an equilibrium population that is subject to the exact same conditions that were used over here to analyze DNDS, namely you have mutations arising at some rate, and at silent sites those mutations behave neutrally, and at selected sites they behave like a Wright-Fisher model under selection. What I'd like to know is, and these sites are independent of each other, if you were to sample two individuals from an equilibrium population under such a situation, what DNDS value will you get if you know the selection pressure on the non-silent sites? And you're right that it's going to be close to one, but how close? So how do we do that? Well, the way I've addressed it is very, very classical. We start with a Wright-Fisher model. So we're going to apply a Wright-Fisher model at each of these individual sites, which are assumed to act independently of each other. For the silent sites, we'll have no selection, and for the selected sites, we'll have some selection. The incarnation of the Wright-Fisher model that I'm going to use is the diffusion equation, which of course is just that if we keep track of the time evolution of the probability density that an allele that has been introduced is at frequency x, then that changes in the following standard forward time way. This is all very classical. And what we're interested in, so here, of course, we have the introduction of mutations. And we have a recurrent mutation model. And what we want to study here is the mutation selection drift equilibrium. And again, for non-silent sites, we'll have a certain fixed value of S. And for silent sites, of course, S will be 0. And what we want, as I said, is in order to calculate the DNDS value that we'll observe between two sampled sequences, we'll let this go to steady state. And I'm going to discuss how to solve for the steady state in a second, which is non-classical. So we let this go to a some steady state distribution f of x, f hat of x, and we're going to approximate DNDS as just the expected, the probability that any given site that's non-silent, that two sampled individuals differ, compared to the probability that any given site that's silent, two individuals differ. So that's just let's say f hat of x given gamma and theta. Given 0 and theta, namely selection on the denominator is 0. So that's going to be our relationship between gamma, theta, and the expected DNDS. once we solve for this equilibrium steady state F hat, so here gets to here's the rub. The trick here, though, is that since we've phrased this as an individual site model, a single site Wright-Fisher model, we have to think pretty hard about what the boundary conditions are going to be such that we can solve this steady state distribution. So if we have imagined frequencies of x between 0 and 1, the typical steady state distribution that is solved here is to assume a flux 0 condition. And this gives you a classic mutation selection drift steady state that was derived, I think, by Wright, first of all. But the condition that we need to really mimic in this one state, one site model, the selective model that had been studied for DNDS, is the condition that when a mutation reaches frequency 1, when a mutation fixes, it then becomes the new resident type. And any subsequent mutation that arises at that site experiences the same selection pressure that the previous one did. In other words, we need to take, if there's positive selection pushing frequencies this way, we need to take lineages that reach frequency 1 and somehow move them immediately to frequency 0 such that subsequent mutations that arise at the site will then experience the same selection coefficient, positive gamma, that the first one did. Is that much clearer?
You need a solution with a finite flux.
Yes, a finite but not zero flux.
Yes.
A flux that goes this way.
So
okay.
If there are no mutations during time to fixation, why is it different from infinite number of sites model? Because
I am actually going to allow, though it's going to make it's just a slight approximation. I am going to actually allow mutations during the time of fixation, but those will occur extremely rarely. And it's different from an infinite sites model because I want to cast it on a per site basis so I can use this kind of approximation. But an infinite sites model, then I have an infinite number of sites that have not even seen a mutation, and which I cannot even address. I can't use this kind of approximation. So I would like to do it at a per site basis. And as you say, I want a solution that has a constant but non-zero flux, So
can you just say again why that integral is the end of ds?
Yeah.
Okay, f hat is the spatial redistribution frequencies.
Right. So if f hat is the spatial redistribution. Okay. So there's a slight approximation here, which I almost didn't want to get involved in. But loosely speaking, the reason why is that imagine sampling two individuals. And let's just say they have each have a silent site and a an amino acid encoding site. Now, the expected, so what is DN? It's the expected number of differences at amino acid encoding sites, which is the problem. How would you get a difference at an amino acid encoding site? It would depend upon the frequency that an allele, a segregating allele, is at in equilibrium. And if it's at frequency X, the probability that in two individuals you get a difference is 2x, 1 minus X. And so too for silent sites.
So that integral is like an integral over many independent sites with the same distribution.
Exactly. We're going to use this calculation that's at a single site and sort of think about it being applied to many sites that are all independent. This is a steady state distribution in the sense that all sites will have x's drawn from this f hat.
This is the ratio of diversities at a given point in time.
This is a measure of polymorphism.
This is a measure of the polymorphism diversity. So the one point in time.
Dn over ds rather than dn over.
Well, but if you actually, but the point is that if you go to a population and you sample two individuals and you sequence them and you compare them, which is what people did in these studies, this is really what they're calculating.
I'm very happy.
Yeah. Maybe you don't want to call it.
Whether we're looking for, fixed differences or polymorphisms, and naively you would think that the dependence on S will be different in the sense that, unless we play games with boundary conditions, in the sense that a strongly selected thing is going to disappear as a polymorphism, right? whereas it's going to appear.
Right, this is what we're going to see, yeah.
Right, so, but this is because we're looking at a different object.
Point is that when in, yes, you're absolutely right. This, everything you said is absolutely perfectly correct, except I would like to add that when people sequence individuals from a population and compare those sequences and use PAML or some package to calculate DNDS and interpret it, what they are doing is, as you said, they're looking at polymorphisms, segregating polymorphisms, and treating them as fixed differences.
Well, not when people compare apes, right? So hopefully what shows up is DN there is sufficiently larger than what would show up as this number of polymorphisms, so that even though, right, you're only comparing individual gorilla to an individual orangutan, right, the difference between them is larger than the interest.
Right, but in these microbial examples, like this typhoid study and studies of HIV within a host and studies of all of those studies I mentioned, they're not comparing orangutans to the gorillas. They're comparing tuberculosis to tuberculosis. Okay, let's just continue with this.
If it's within a population, then we shouldn't talk about fixed differences.
That's correct.
But we should be talking about the P and over P.
Yeah, so maybe the right notation with this for this would, in fact, exactly the PN over PS.
Since last week we spent a lot of time arguing over ratios of P, ratios of D.
But then I really don't understand why you want a boundary condition.
Well, I want this boundary condition because it is under this boundary condition that people calculate omega when they take sequences from a single population and feed into a program that calculates the DNDS, right? It's under a model in which selection there's no negative S once something is fixed.
We just agreed that that was wrong, right?
Calculate DN over DS by just integrating the flux that went through your little model there over the divergence time.
Sure.
So the flux is in fact this substitution rate, is what we have before.
Yeah.
This is just the value of the flux.
So you calculate the steady state flux and you multiply it by the time and
there's no time since divergence. What do you mean time since divergence? In the applications here there is no divergence.
Right. So there is no flux.
No, there is a flux. There's a steady state flux in this direction.
Well, I know that you're going to demand it is, but I mean that seems in reality, there will not be.
Because he needs to maintain a steady state with basically a single site, and in reality, it's an infinite site model, and one site pops out, another one pops in, and he just wants to call the next one, equate the next one to the first one.
This is a kludge for looking at what is really an infinite site model within the context of one site. And the kludge is to say that when something fixes, you just put it back to frequency zero, so the subsequent mutation, which in reality is at the next site, experiences the same selection pressure gamma.
I agree that that was a bad approximation.
No, that's not a bad approximation.
This is perfect. This is exactly the kind of boundary condition that gives you the familiar 1 over x dk for neutral and a little bit more like for negative and a little bit like this. Because you have two different boundaries, the boundary where it gets in, where there's the pole and the other.
Okay, so let's say you don't do it. Let's say you just say every side has a preferred state and it has an unpreferred state. And there is just some frequency distribution under your model that you're going to get in steady state, right towards the preferred or the non-preferred side. And there's just a certain probability that if you pick a pair of guides, that one will have the preferred state and one will have the non-preferred state, right? Why doesn't that work? What is wrong with that solution?
There's nothing wrong with that solution. The issue is that when people calculate DNDS on such sequences, how should they interpret that value in terms of selection? And so this is the boundary condition that will allow you to answer that question, right? Because they're calculating DNDS in an infinite site setting, where every mutation experiences the same selection pressure over the resident type.
Another way to say this is that people polarize polymorphism with respect to the ancestors. And this is why we need this estimate.
There's one thing I don't understand here. So if you have this boundary condition, and you mentioned that mutations are very rare. So I can use infinite number of site forms staying for a very long time at the same site.
Right.
But then what goes here is distribution of sojourn times. Right? So
yeah, the reason why I didn't take
it's not for this gap, it's for sojourn time around frequency x. And then it should be exactly what you're saying, or I'm missing something here.
I think that approach will actually be that's a very similar approach, except that the problem will be that if you were to use it, I'm not sure, you could not use an equation like this to calculate the expected DNDS if you have an infinite sites model, because you're going to have an infinite number of sites that are monomorphic. This is really the problem.
No, I take one site, and I'm saying that mutation happens, diffuses, also goes for fixation, conjugating, and what I want to use here, I want to get FX. I compute probability that I spend
but the problem with that, so the sojourn time will not be appropriate, right? Because what goes into DNDS, there are lots of sites that do not differ between two individuals, not because they're both at low frequency, but because they have not yet even acquired a mutation. So if you just look at the sojourn time, then you're going to underestimate the number of sites that do not differ between your two samples because they haven't yet acquired a mutation. Okay, so let me just proceed with this. This is all really classical at this point. This equation has, I don't know if you want me to write it on the board, it has a well-known constant flux solution, the zero flux solution of which was written down by Wright and Watterson, and the positive but constant flux solution, let me just write it down. The steady state solution to this is of the form f hat of x given gamma and theta is equal to x 1 minus x to the theta minus 1 e to the 2 gamma x times c1 psi of x plus c2, where psi of x is the integral from x to 1 of z 1 minus z to the minus theta e to the minus 2 gamma z dz. And the point is that the classical solution with zero flux arises when c1 is 0, and whereas the solution that we want that takes probabilities going into 1 and moves it over to 0 arises when c2 is 0 and c1 is a constant that's determined that is determined by the fact that the total integral of f has to be 1. Okay, so C1 equals to 0 goes to the solution of Wright, and C2 equal to 0 goes to our solution with non-zero flux.
Is it minus theta that you wrote there in the definition of psi?
Yeah, minus theta. Okay, so let me just show you that this works. So here, just to show you that it works, here I've done two Wright-Fisher simulations. In the first simulation, I simulated two divergent populations. And these simulations are simulations at individual sites, and they're under these kinds of conditions. Whenever a new mutation arises, it has a selection pressure gamma compared to its resident type. And when it fixes, it becomes the resident type. And over two independent populations, if you sample two individuals, one from each population, and you calculate DNDS, what I'm showing here is the DNDS that you get over many sites as a function of the gamma. And this curve here is the Nielsen-Yang prediction over long time scales. And the point is this Wright-Fisher simulation gives you this curve. Exactly, it has to. Here is the exact same simulation, but just instead of sampling one individual from two divergent populations, like two different monkeys. I sampled two individuals from the same population, and I show here in these boxes the DNDS you get observed in simulations, and this is the predicted DNDS by this steady state solution. So this works. And so the bottom line is that whereas this is the relationship between selection and DNDS over very long time scales, namely when selection is negative, DNDS goes to zero very quickly. When selection is positive, DNDS becomes very, very much bigger than one. These curves are the relationship between selection and DNDS over short time scales, let's say for individuals from the same population. And this, I think, helps explain a lot of these quizzical observations in the literature of microbial samples. So for example, in microbes, the point here is that in microbes, for samples from a single population, people were typically finding DNDS values very near 1 and concluding that there must not be strong selection. The point here, of course, is that even with quite moderate selection, like negative 4, that would have over long time scales depressed DNDS to 0, samples from the same population might have DNDS of 0.8 or so. And so I think it's inappropriate, actually, to conclude that there's a lack of selection operating on genes when you sample microbial sequences, compare them, and find DNDS values near 1. The point is that for such samples, since they're in a single population, exactly as you said, the relationship between selection and DNDS is completely different than it is over long time scales.
The problem seems to be so that the people then have an idea where sort of the boundary between within their population and between population lies for these microbial populations. Because obviously, so one of them is polymorphism and the other is substitution. They are two fundamentally different limits.
Well, but it's really a continuum between the two. And not only that, I guess.
I wanted to talk about this side for a second. Then let's get to this issue of when are you really in two different populations. So of course, and this is also, I think, very intuitive, but for polymorphisms, as gamma gets large, DNDS is not only not expected to go up, it's non-monotonic and come back down. And in fact, as gamma gets very large, DNDS will go to 0, which is, again, entirely intuitive. Within a population, if mutations arise that are strongly selected, they will sweep fix quickly. And in equilibrium, if you sample two individuals, you will see no observed differences. So, so getting to this question of whether or not in any particular realistic population, are the samples from a single population, or are they from some sort of divergent structures? I think the answer is we typically don't know the answer to that question. And as a result, we cannot make many informative conclusions based on the DNDS statistic for microbes, because if, in fact, those samples are from closely related or individuals within a single population, a DNDS value of 0.7 is equally consistent with negative selection and very strong positive selection. And so I think this means, in the end, that for microbial samples, this kind of statistic, although it's widely used, is probably not informative even for the sign of selection, let alone the strength.
Can you use a Humboldt algorithm why that goes down again on both sides? Like, why does the 0.5 curve go down?
Yes, I can. I can give you a very simple intuition. It's just that imagine that as gamma gets, well, first of all, we can prove it asymptotically from this expression. But also, just the intuition is that if gamma is very strongly positive and a mutation arises in a population and we have independent sites, that mutation, once it arises, will fix very quickly. It has a little bit of period of drift, but if gamma is extremely strong and positive, the mutation will fix very quickly. And so in a steady state where you have mutations arising, each experiencing this gamma, you will find very few differences at such non-synonymous sites because they will have all been swept out immediately. So then the DNDS value has to go down to 0. Does that give some intuition?
Because they're still in the same population.
Right.
There are two effects. One is the probability of establishment, right? This new mutation has to overcome the drift, right? And that's where selection helps. But much selection, establishment pops out too fast.
So I thought to be not that they just these two effects compensate, so that we get something very slowly.
Well, these are the curves for different thetas. they match Wright-Fisher simulations.
So you could do what Eric wanted to do, which is to not have this flux, and just have to have backwards and forwards positive and negative substitutions. You could plot the same curves, right?
Well, it would be symmetric, right? Because there is no direction.
Yeah.
So what would that look like?
What would that look like? Exactly. It would go to one at gamma of zero. Yes, that's exactly how it would look. But I'm not. Again, that's not.
Still seems to me that's more sensible than.
Well, that's a more sensible model of selection, but that's not the model of selection that people use when they discuss the NDS.
Yeah, it's fair to say that this issue is not kind of unknown to people, aware of population genetics and the foundation of the flux. Those papers actually wouldn't have been published in the journal of Molecular Evolution. They'll get published in Nature or Nature Genetics. Who reviews those papers? So, but it's well worth, in itself, because you see this kind of wholesale misapplication. And there's another issue that's equally pernicious, and in some cases maybe more so, that maybe you won't discuss. And that is when you apply packages such as PAML. I mean, some days you can just, you're talking about, like, you just take a pair of sequences, your two sequences, and you calculate something like DNDS. But the way PAML works, where you have a whole sample of sequences or a sample of species, is that you have to supply a phylogeny to, and it actually calculates or estimates these ratios on all the branches given its mutation model, but the relationship of those sequences are given. When you're dealing with intra-species data, in fact, because of the problem we've talked about for weeks now, and there is some amount of recombination, the genealogy of one part of the protein can be quite different from the other. And so in the case of PAML, so you're just taking some kind of average genealogy that actually doesn't apply to any of the specific sites. And then you're looking for some sites where it looks like there's too many substitutions on the tree. And of course, that may just be a region or a site that has an unusually deep genealogy, just purely for stochastic genealogical reasons. And there's been more substitutions on that branch. And so it misestimates those values. And actually, operationally, there's even another.
No, I think there are even bigger issues. But this issue is pervasive. I mean, there are hundreds of papers, including, by the way, the paper that derived the long time scale relationship, applied that relationship to HIV-B samples that had all been sampled from the same patient, and inferred selection pressures, including positive selection and negative selection, based on the observed DNDS values, inferred those. This is a paper published in a population genetics journal. Inferred them using the long time scale equation. So I haven't seen this worked out, the relationship between selection and DNDS in a population.
Maybe that's true. If the right model is being used, I think DNDS is explained.
Well, we caution.
I think I'll wrap my head around your model. I'm sorry, I'm going to be slow. So your model here, if mutation, if you do allow for mutations, little bit. So if you don't, I think it's like a phenotype model. So if you do allow for mutations, then you don't have. So if I mutate from what was resident state, or if I mutated from resident state and on the way to before fixation, mutate again back. So how would you treat this variant? What would be fixed?
Okay. So yeah, if you're going this way and you mutate back, then that mutation is to the resident type and has fitness one, whereas the new one has fitness 1 plus F. It's only when the new mutant fixes that you reassess, that you reassign fitnesses. Yeah. But that event is extremely rare, that during the fixation of one type, there's a it has very little effect on this steady state distribution. It's only one individual going back to.
But if it is rare, the curves should be, as people got from infinite number of sites.
No, it can't be, because the infinite number of site calculations, as you said, depend only on the sojourn times. And they do not account. I mean, in the PRF model, you have an infinite number of sites that have not yet even acquired a mutation.
Right,
and
but
so you can't.
With data, so this is expectation. This is expectation. This is not a probability. So
right. This is the
number of variants. Mm-hmm. which are polymorphic with this frequency. So well, you can probably explain it to me later. And,
I struggled to do that. I tried to use the sojourn time distribution to get an expression for DNDS that's accurate. And I found that once you have a polymorphism, it works very well. But there are many sites that have not yet even acquired mutations, which have to be accounted for in
but
some sort of steady state.
Those are if you scale with theta, those would be expected failures. So the metamorphic sites are included in
those. Well, I'd love to talk about trying to get another an alternative expression.
Yeah.
OK, fine. So I wanted to talk about something pretty different for the second half. Do you want to take a break, Marty, or do you want to? So the next thing I wanted to talk about, and again, it's at least in the context of interpreting microbial data. But this is, I think, farther removed from data and not actually a practical issue, at least yet, is what are appropriate models, again, at single site, so none of the complications about linkage, but what are appropriate models, the dynamics of segregating alleles in a microbial population. So this is work in collaboration with Chris Quince and Todd Parsons. In fact, these guys actually formulated this model. So this is sort of, as a motivation, I just want to take us through the following kind of thought experiment. Oh, by the way, these slides, you'll notice, are all a very different format. This is you're privy to like a really wonderful moment in the development of a scientist. I've moved full time now from PowerPoint to LaTeX for slides, and so I think this is much better. So these slides are finally all teched. So the sort of thought experiment is we have isolated two strains of a bug, X1 and X2, and we're asking the following kind of question, which is very natural. Is the mutant type advantageous over the wild type? And so one way we might answer that is to compete these two strains in a lab. So we put the two strains, initially very small numbers, in a rich medium, and we watch them grow, and we fit exponential growth curves. And in this case, for these data, X2, I'm always going to use X2 for the mutant type in this discussion, the red type here, is advantageous. It has a faster exponential growth rate. So that's one way to actually commonly use to assess the selection difference. So alternatively, and this is also commonly used in field studies, as it were, we might go into the field and observe these two strains and repeatedly sample them, let's just say in time. Maybe also across space or across sites if we assume gamma is the same. But let's just say we repeatedly sample in time and score whether or not our samples of type X1 or type X2. And then we get essentially a frequency spectrum of the mutant allele. We can bin it, and we can fit a steady state, in this case the classical steady state Wright-Fisher model, to this frequency spectrum and infer, in this case, that X2 is disadvantageous. There's more time spent with the wild type. So these are two different ways. One is a manipulative experiment. One is just surveys.
So you're taking samples, and then in each sample, you calculate the fraction that is X1.
Exactly. We calculate the frequency of the sample frequency of the allele. So this is all, I think, straightforward enough. We have this time series. We have this sampled, except for the fact that in this case, both of these data sets came from the same population. In this case, a simulated population. And this is a problem, right? If when you go into the lab and you compete two strains, you infer that the mutant type is advantageous, whereas over a long period of time, if you were to just sample the allele frequency spectrum, you'd observe that the other type is advantageous. So to the extent that this actually happens in reality, this would be a problem for us. And the reason why this, and I'm going to describe how this problem arose, and I think it really would only arise in certain microbial situations, but in the end, the reason why this was a problem in this case is because we used the Wright-Fisher model to infer the selection pressure from this steady-state allele frequency spectrum. And of course, the Wright-Fisher model relies on three really essential assumptions. Initially, that generations are discrete and non-overlapping. that individuals in each generation produce a Poisson number of offspring conditioned on the fact that the total number of individuals in the next generation is constant and a finite size n. And this is, I guess, I don't actually know what Wright and Fisher were thinking of. I think they were thinking of annual plants. This is perfectly reasonable for certain annual plants. But it's not, I don't think, even at a single site, reasonable for E. coli, because E. coli are most emphatically not Wright-Fisher. Generations overlap. They sort of divide in continuous time. Individuals hardly produce a Poisson number of offspring. They divide by binary fission. They produce either one or zero offspring. And more importantly, lineages die independently of birth events. And so as a result, the population size is not fixed. It varies stochastically in time. So all of these central assumptions of Wright-Fisher are certainly violated in many microbial populations. And so what I want to discuss today, or this in this little slides, and this is just work in progress, are some models of that I think are probably slightly more realistic in the context of such populations that divide by binary fission and have stochastically varying population size. I just want to point out that it's not simply that the population size of these E. coli varies. Because, of course, there's a whole field of literature on Wright-Fisher models where we exogenously change the population size. We let it grow exponentially or we let it cycle. And the bottom line of much of that literature is that you can just replace that model with an equivalent Wright-Fisher model, changing the effective population size. The point here, and this is critically different, is that the population size varies stochastically with the same events that might cause changes in the allele number in the population. The birth, when the mutant type X2 gives birth to a new cell, the population size goes up for a period of time. OK, so we've been exploring what I think are ridiculously simple, probably the very simplest models that can account for the simple dynamics of binary fission. They're essentially birth-death models where we keep track in continuous time of the number of individuals in the population of each of, let's say, k genetic types. And the following really kind of simple events can occur. And this is, by the way, sort of something that we're going to consider as an alternative to the neutral Wright-Fisher model. The following kind of events can occur, and these are extremely simple. The number of individuals of the ith type might increase by one due to births of the ith type at a per capita rate beta I. So each genetic type has an intrinsic birth rate and death rate. Or the number of individuals of the ith type might decrease by one, again, at a per capita intrinsic death rate delta. But we also have increased mortality due to density dependence. So this is a term that says that the mortality rate increases as the total number of individuals of all types approaches some sort of carrying capacity. So we have density-dependent quadratic mortality rates. And it turns out, for everything I'm going to say, if we had had density-dependent birth rates, it would have been completely equivalent. In fact, slightly easier to work out all this stuff. But we just have some sort of density dependence in the vital rates. So I think this is more or less the simplest model you could write down for division of different types in a cell culture. And of course, you can change the model to include mutation. We could have a possibility that when a cell divides, it gives rise to a daughter cell that is of one of the other K genetic types. Okay, so now for a few little mathy comments. So first of all, this system, this birth-death system, over finite time intervals, as the system size gets large, the appropriately scaled system converges weakly to this very natural deterministic limit. And this deterministic limit has the property that it permits stable coexistence of all those types that have the same ratio of their birth to death rates. This is, I think, a very natural condition. It just says that all the genetic types that have the same expected lifetime reproductive output, which is given by beta over delta, can, if they have all the same expected reproductive output, then in the deterministic limit, they can stably coexist. It's weak. It's convergence in probability, convergence in distribution. I'm happy to talk about exactly what kind of convergence there is after. This is, it's actually an it's different from the kind of convergence that you see in.
Was in the dual space.
Yes, it's in dual space. Yes. Okay, so for most of this little talk, I'm going to focus on the case where all the genetic types have the same ratio of birth to death rates, constant ratio. They all have the same expected reproductive output in their lifetime. And this is what we've called the quasi-neutral case, for reasons that you'll see in just a second. And I'm going to focus on this case. It turns out that a lot of these results will hold even with small departures from this, and I'd be happy to talk about that. But I'm going to focus on this case mainly because it is the equivalent of neutrality in this model. So first of all, in this case, there's sort of a trade-off between birth and death rates. One genetic type might have an increased cell division rate, but it also has an increased rate at which the lineage dies, or a cell dies, such that this ratio is constant. And what that means is that, again, in the deterministic limit, they will all coexist, and they will all have the same carrying capacity and star. And the important point is that, and this follows, I think, from a result from Gillespie, that if in the corresponding fixed population size model, where we don't allow the population size to vary stochastically, the fact that these all have the same expected reproductive output means that they would all have the exact same value of Kimura's selection coefficient S in a fixed population size model. In other words, in a fixed population size model, these types would be strictly neutral types. They would behave neutrally. However, in this model where the population size varies stochastically, the behavior is actually very different, and that's really what I want to talk about. So first of all, this should be X1 and X2. This is a figure showing two sample paths of this stochastic system, and it captures what are the main qualitative behavior, that even if you start from low population numbers, very quickly the system will move to its carrying capacity N star. The total population size will reach its carrying capacity very quickly, and thereafter it'll more or less diffuse along that submanifold. It will diffuse at or near a carrying capacity. And in some sense, the point of the talk is that you might think, because in a corresponding fixed population size model, these types would be strictly neutral, that this diffusion here would be simply Wright-Fisher neutral diffusion. And in fact, and this is the point of the talk, this diffusion along near carrying capacity will be, as you see in a second, very far from neutral. So and I'm not going to go through the details or really present all these results, but what Todd and I have been doing is essentially working out all the classical population genetic quantities that you would have for a Wright-Fisher model, like the probability that the mutant fixes, the time until it fixes, or the time until it's lost from the population, the steady-state frequency distribution with recurrent mutation. We've basically gone through and tried to work all those out for this alternative quasi-neutral model. I just want to show you some of those results briefly to give you a feeling for how it differs from true neutrality. So first of all, focusing on the fixation probability of a mutant type. So here's an expression. I'm not going to even tell you how we derived it. For the asymptotically correct expression, the probability that the mutant type X2 will fix eventually, given that its initial frequency in the population is sigma, and also assuming that the population is at least initially at carrying capacity, this N star. And the point right off the bat is that this expression for the probability of fixation of the mutant is very different from the Wright-Fisher neutral expression.
Of course, beta 1, beta 2.
Sure. Beta 2 and beta 1 are the birth rates of the mutant type and the wild type. Okay, so in this model, the mutant type has a higher birth rate, but it also has a higher death rate.
Because the ratios are the same.
The ratios are the same.
Basically, you get a correction to the Wright-Fisher thing because these two different populations operate at different time scales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You get this correction provided you're at carrying capacity. It's not the same correction. The correction, it turns out, depends upon the current population, total population size.
But the leading order term is the same.
The leading order term is the same. So first of all, notice that this correction favors fixation of the type that has lower birth rates, right? If beta 2 is lower, then then the mutant type is more likely to fix. Even though the mutant type has the same expected reproductive output as the wild type, and even though these types would be completely neutral in a Wright-Fisher model.
They sort of drift with different rates, right? They drift with different rates.
They drift with different rates. Yes, they have different diffusion.
Average, right? Because of
yes, one of them is more variable. Exactly, they drift with different rates. And in particular, and this is the right intuition, that the type with lower birth rates is simply less variable. It has lower drift. And so what's happening here, and I think this is exactly your intuition, is that the type with lower birth rates and lower death rates, although it has the same expected output, it's not as likely to drift all the way down to frequency zero and be lost from the population. And that's why it has a higher probability of fixating, because the other type is more likely to be lost in the population.
Can I just ask a biology question? So is carrying capacity is supposed to model what? The stationary state? So we have the bacteria growing exponentially.
Right.
And,
right. It's carrying capacity here is supposed to model some sort of nutrient limitation that regulates the total population size of any population. So in a very simple bacterial culture and glucose, the availability of glucose is what determines carrying capacity.
Once they reach saturation, they stop growing.
Well, they don't divide often, but
so the rates change. I mean, in the real saturation.
Right, but they change here too. The death. Well, as I said, we could have put the density dependence in the birth rate, and that they would divide very, very seldom. At carrying capacity.
But if you're talking about a chemostat, then what?
No, this.
Right. It's not just nutrients being expended, but that nutrients are available as a constant rate.
So this is, I think, less relevant to a chemostat. Was that what you were saying? No, because in a chemostat,
A chemostat really looks like Wright-Fisher, right? Because
yeah, chemostat. Yeah. You're always giving it more nutrients, and the fact that population size is kept roughly constant is not due to density-dependent regulation. It's because you simply remove cells from the chemostat at a certain rate.
Is it again a biology question I guess? So E. coli lives in the gut. So the death rates, do they fall apart?
This is actually we're trying to do an experiment on. Videotaping these E. coli, but yes, cells both divide and at some point they atrophy, and the cell wall is lost, and that lineage dies, as it were. That happens more rarely than cell division, of course, but it certainly happens.
Again, coming back to the chemostat, shouldn't the intuition that we just mentioned here also apply to the chemostat, the one with the higher birth rate, drifts stronger in frequency, even in the chemostat, so that maybe some of these results carry over to that?
Yes, maybe. I haven't.
The experimental testing.
Right, so that would require. Yeah, I haven't.
But in the chemostat, the death rate is the same for everybody, because death is you flush, flush out.
Right,
it's the same for everybody, so then it's just difference in
the. Right, the density, the population size regulation in this model, and I really haven't studied what would be an appropriate model for a chemostat, is driven by density-dependent in either birth or death rates, whereas in the chemostat, it's entirely exogenous. And I think it's going to be much, much better approximated by Wright-Fisher for a chemostat.
So is this difference due to fluctuations in the overall population size? Because if I thought, oftentimes when you have a new mutant, you will model this with a branching process. And all I'm doing is scaling the time scale here. That's what you're doing by changing this parameter alpha. And that doesn't change my expectation of what the end result.
So I'm not going to change alpha. Alpha is fixed for this result.
Sorry, not alpha. Yeah. You don't have a name for it, but just the other parameter that gives the changing the birth rate with alpha fixed.
Changing beta too?
you're changing the time scale on which this branching process happens. I don't see why that would affect my expected outcome of the branching process at infinite time.
But the infinite time is this finite and fixed point, right? Because there's saturation, and now he's just moving on that manifold, right? On the fixed and manifold.
Yeah, moreover, I'm not sure if the branching process approximation is really going to hold for times long enough to even produce this calculation through a branching process. Because, as we just mentioned, they reach this submanifold, their steady state, very quickly. And at that point, they both have macroscopic frequencies. And so they're interacting with each other. Yeah.
So this is already at macroscopic frequency.
Yes, yes. This is a result from carrying capacity. I'll show you results from lower populations in a second. Okay, but the main point here is that this result is very different from the neutral Wright-Fisher result, which is just that the probability that the median fixes is independent of, it's equal to its initial frequency.
So one more question. There's no, n doesn't enter in this fixation. Where is the
n? No, n does not enter. N does not enter. The point is that sigma is the relative frequency of, n doesn't enter, nor does n enter here. The probability of fixation of a neutral allele in Wright-Fisher model is given by its current frequency. And that's sort of the same idea here.
Yeah, but I would have expected that maybe in your equation, n should enter and the Wright-Fisher thing should come out for n to infinity. So
yeah. Yeah.
So how do we understand the limiting cases of this? Expression, say, beta 1 was 0, or like approaching 0.
Oh, I haven't thought about that. Of the first limiting case, I think about it.
No, fixation is impossible because these guys are always going to stick around. They're like quasi fossilized.
If beta 1.
Selection to immortality. You've got selection for long lifetimes, and immortality is the best thing.
Right, there's guys that are just frozen. They're just waiting for the other guys to hit 0 once, and then they're
Well, that's so that you can probably calculate some kind of large deviation extinction probability type calculation. But the fixation probability should go to 0 in that case, shouldn't it?
Of which type? This is the fixation probably of type 2.
Yeah, say type 1 was immortal. Or is it a, alpha being constant, beta 1.
The type 2 cannot fix because there's always type 1.
Yeah.
And the type 1 will never go to 0.
Well, so the problem here is that if you let beta go to 0, this is, of course, in the regime where we've assumed that the ratios of beta, you're letting the death rate of the wild type go to infinity. Or rather go to 0 as well, actually.
No,
yeah, so they don't die, yeah. They just sit there, so you cannot fix. And that makes sense. Yeah.
Does it give a 0 in that case? So if we just take out beta 1 there?
It gives me, like, sigma squared.
Gives me sigma squared, yeah. Well, maybe it's a mathematical limit that there's some
yeah,
dependent to change.
Yeah, I wonder why that doesn't work out. I should say that these results only hold when alpha is not arbitrarily small. In other words,
but alpha is just
alpha has to be bigger than 1 for these results to hold. Yeah.
I see, but you couldn't take alpha to be, it has to be bigger than what you say?
They have to have an expected positive growth rate, or else the whole thing is going to...
They're always sort of pushing against carrying capacity.
Yeah. They're not. Right. The whole system isn't going to go extinct quickly, is what all I'm trying to say. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood correctly your model, but mutation rate is not in the equation, right? Because you can lose your recurring by mutating out of the
right, right, right.
Rather than dying.
If mu equals 0.
Sorry.
I'll put the mutation in a second. So here's a graph showing the. So here we in this situation we start the population in all cases with an equal number of these two types, wild type X1 and X2. And we ask what's the probability of the mutant type fixing. And in some of these cases, we start the population very far from carrying capacity at low density. In some of the cases, we start at carrying capacity at high density. And the point is that, and this is, again, an entirely non-classical result that could never occur under Wright-Fisher, that depending upon the population size you start at, one or the other of the two types is favored to fix. So here at high density, we have the result we just saw a second ago, that the type with low birth rates is more likely I have this backwards. Oh yeah, no. The type with low birth rates, that is to say, the mutant type, is more likely to. The wild type is more likely to fix, and here at low density, the type with high birth rates is more likely to fix. If the population starts at very far from carrying capacity, and I think this is also intuitive. If you start very far from carrying capacity, then the type with higher birth and death rates is sort of going to get an exponential head start, right? And again, this holds, you get different results on which is more favorable to fix. This holds even though they both would be neutral in a constant population size model. So the intuition here that I just mentioned is that when you're at high density, low birth and death rates are favored because you fluctuate less, you have a different diffusion constant. And when the population is initially at low density, the type with high birth and death rates is favored because it's going to immediately outcompete the other one. And this, in a nutshell, explains the weird enigma that I started this talk with, where when in the lab we compete two types, one of them wins, we let them go for a long time into equilibrium, the other one wins. And this is, just to remind you, is occurring in a model that is far more realistic for microbes than Wright-Fisher.
But I mean, just a slight difference in the ratios.
So, no, it's not pathological to that. I was going to talk about that later, but if you do an expansion of beta, so that the first term is such that the betas to the deltas are constant, and the second term in order 1 over n, is a deviation from that, then differences, the basic answer is that differences in the ratio of order 1 over n enter as selection terms just as an equal strength as the selection associated with having higher or low beta. I can tell you more about that, but no. This is robust to changing that ratio a little bit.
So you could say that this in itself is an explanation of a stationary state. So whatever alleles for stationary states were selected and fixated. And stationary state
right.
is a reduction right. of birth rate and high density.
Yes, that's possible, I guess. I mean, they would only fix once you get to high density, but yeah.
That's yeah. Good, okay. right? Yeah. So you select for high growth things, and then they reach stationarity,
and the, other, and, the new alleles.
Then, you switch into a different state, right? So you turn on.
Yes, this
yeah,
is.
The key some thing other is that your behavior. Death rate must go down too. I mean, it doesn't help you to lower your birth rate unless it also lowers your.
But it does. I mean, they just go stationary.
Yeah, they just don't do much at all in the station.
Okay, but that is the part that is not
the correlation, right?
What causes them to die? Right.
So this is a biological question,
right.
And I certainly don't understand this. I'm not sure how well it is understood, but apparently, there's certain these lineages really do age. That the same lineage of cells start to divide slower and slower. You can tell which in the cell division in E. coli, which one is retaining most of the DNA. I don't think it's entirely understood what causes them to die.
Can I ask you a quick question, just to see if I understand this? So if I'm thinking of myself as the type, and I'm going to pick a strategy, if I'm at a high density, then I want to have...
Not if you're at, but if the whole population, if the total population size is at a high density.
Or population, so at carrying capacity.
If the population's at carrying capacity. Does that help?
The actual density at the carrying capacity is scaled up.
That's correct.
The parameter that's used, correct. Like how dense is the...
No. When I say high density, that's maybe a very deceptive term. Yes, I mean, how close are you to carrying capacity? The actual value of the carrying capacity doesn't matter.
In general, that might matter in some more complicated population models.
Yes, I mean, so it turns out it matters a little bit. If the carrying capacity were very low, then the whole thing system would go extinct before any of these things happen. But n has to be, these are asymptotic results in the system size, so n has to be large enough, and in the simulations that I'll show you in a second, even just 100 is big enough, that it really takes exponentially long for the whole population to go extinct.
So when I'm at high density, there's pressure on the entire population to die out. And so I'm selecting against the high birth death rate because they're more susceptible over the time period.
Correct.
During which this happens.
Correct. When you're at high density, there's selection for lowering your birth and death rate.
Might then also be the regime, okay, where the carrying capacity is lower, then the total population size fluctuates more, right? And then there could also be the regime where, again, the high birth rate type is selected for, because you have...
So, again, I haven't... for me, in this analysis, the actual value of the carrying capacity scales out. So there may be regimes where that is so low that different things happen. But as I show you in just a second, even if the carrying capacity is just 100 cells, then all of these asymptotic equations still are quite accurate. Okay, so let me just show you a few other funny things that can happen in this model that really are just sort of sequela of this central idea. Here's a population where we start the population with equal, at a high carrying capacity, with equal frequency of the two types, and we bottleneck the population at different frequencies and different serial jobs. And the point here is that the frequency with which the population is bottlenecked determines which of the two types is more likely to fix. So if the population is bottlenecked very infrequently, then the type with low birth rates is going to fix, and if it's bottled very frequently, then the type with high birth rates is likely to fix. And again, this simply cannot occur under a Wright-Fisher model. Under a Wright-Fisher model, like the bottle, if you start at frequency 1/2, the bottleneck frequency is irrelevant. And I think this is probably relevant to microbes that infect people, and when they're infecting someone, they typically are bottlenecked.
Well, one question about how this model behaves if we don't completely fix Dr. Jeffrey, but allowed slightly changing, because biologically it's hard to imagine mutation which would absolutely exactly.
Yes, this is exactly Eric's question, and again, I'd be happy to talk about this in real detail afterwards. But the basic result is deviations from a strict equality of the birth to death rate, deviations of order 1/n, enter as selection terms of equal magnitude to differences in the birth rate. So this is. In other words, deviations from strict quasi-neutrality, from strict ratios, are of comparable magnitude to deviations differences in birth rates. In other words, it's not pathological in that sense.
So this is still relevant.
This is still relevant, yeah. For example, you could have a slight difference if you had a difference of 1% in that ratio, but you had a difference of 20% in the birth rates, this feature would dominate.
Oh, I thought you said only differences of order 1/n.
Yeah, 1/n, sorry. So maybe you need 0.001%. In other words, 0.001% and 0.002% or something. Yeah, they need to be of order 1/n, that's correct. Okay, so we've worked out really all of the classical population genetic quantities, such as the time to absorption of an allele. This is an expression for the time to absorption of the mutant type. And if the two birth rates are exactly equal, it reduces to this classical expression for the time to absorption of the allele. And by the way, this tells us something I think that's sort of interesting. That's that if you have a model where the two birth rates and death rates are actually exactly equal, and the population size varies stochastically, then the classical Wright-Fisher result still holds. if you replace n by the expected long-term average of the population size, the carrying capacity. In other words, for truly neutral types, the Wright-Fisher result holds even for stochastic population sizes. However, if the types just deviate even slightly from true neutrality, very different qualitative behavior occurs. In fact, this is the pathological result. Okay, I'm not going to go over this. The thing I want to talk about, however, is including mutation finally at last. You asked about what our model had mutation. So if we actually include mutation, we can also derive what is essentially the polymorphism frequency spectrum, the steady state distribution of the frequency of the relative frequency of, in this case, I think the wild type, conditioned on that the whole population has not gone extinct, which takes forever to happen anyways. And this expression, if you look at it, just ignore this initial term here, it looks a lot like the classical Wright-Fisher expression. You know, we have roughly something like sigma to the theta 1 minus sigma to the theta minus 1, 1 minus sigma to the theta minus 1, but these thetas have now been modulated by differences in birth rates. But the critical thing is that, and this is the fun thing, there's also this exponential term here, which doesn't occur in the neutral Wright-Fisher model, but does occur, of course, we just saw it a second ago here, in the Wright-Fisher model with selection. And as a result of that, what this means is that if you were to look, and this is how I started the talk, at the frequency spectrum of these two types in equilibrium, it looks like this. This is when the mutant type has twice the birth rate. This spectrum is biased towards the wild type that has half the birth rate. And the spectrum looks virtually identical to a Wright-Fisher spectrum with selection for the wild type, or selection against the mutant type. And this means that this is just explaining why it was the case that if you were to fit frequency spectra data from such a population, you would think it looks just like Wright-Fisher with selection, and you would conclude selection for one of the two types, whereas if you went in the lab and competed them, you'd get the exact opposite result. Okay, so that's all I really want to say. Some conclusions are that it really does matter that we, when people assume fixed-size populations for microbial samples, for microbial dynamics, and instead of fixed size, I should say deterministic sizes. If you allow the Wright-Fisher model to have a population size that varies deterministically, that's more or less just another Wright-Fisher model. But what we're seeing here is that if the population size varies stochastically, then things look very, very different. Another sort of message is that, you know, we're so used to quantifying selection with a single parameter, S, the birth rate, or sort of the relative reproductive output. But the point here is that although that's attractive, that can be very deceiving. If we apply models that assume that selection is mediated by a single parameter S, we can reach erroneous and, what is far worse, completely self-contradictory conclusions, depending upon whether we look at the populations at different times. And so I think we, at least for microbes, we need to consider models that are sort of closer to this, models where we actually model the dynamics of birth and death of cells, and we account for the fact that population size are going to vary. And that's at least a possible project as opposed to impossible. Okay. So are there any other questions about this?
So if you have your birth and death to be independent parameters, then there's obviously going to be selection to increase the birth rate as fast as possible and keep the death rate low, or let the death rate go down. Right? So if you're going to have that in the model, you have to be some. There has to be some constraint. This can't be an
some
impossibly wonderful. Yes.
Yeah.
So how would you put that in? I mean, it's not clear that birth and death are related, really, in a very direct way.
So you're sort of in an adaptive dynamics framework where we like allow these things to.
Well, there must be some trade-off, otherwise, I mean, there must be something preventing you multiplying infinitely fast.
Right.
There must be something preventing you dying infinitely slow. So.
Yeah, I mean, short answer is I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, of course, it's still the case that in Wright-Fisher model of selection, you'd have selection for higher and higher in S, and we don't worry about that. We just say this is the model for a particular value of S. I mean, we could think of a million ad hoc ways to limit the birth rate in a model where we allow the birth rate to itself vary. I don't know which of those would be biologically reasonable.
But it kind of looks like for your low density phase, you know, it's reasonable to assume that you know, bacteria, when they're happy and grow and proliferate, they don't die much. So for practical purposes, that's your regime of exponential expansion, and you don't really need the death rate there, right? Which is grow exponentially, perhaps with some whatever multiplicative randomness there, right? Which will get averaged out once numbers get large, right? But then when you go into, or they go into a high density phase, right, something else happens. So then when the death kicks in, right? And then conceivably you can have these two different states, the same ratio of birth and death rate. And then you indeed have more than just fitness differential. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I knew whether or not it, I mean, I don't know if there are any data on this, whether or not cell culture is growing with rich media.
You look at the elements as movies.
This is exactly what I'm trying to do, is look at these movies.
You'll see how many cells die.
Right, so that's exactly what we're doing now. We're scoring.
Correlation, right? I mean,
well, not in these equal.
No, but I mean, this has evolved, right?
But correlation is part of one of those multiple alpha and beta scenarios at high density.
Right. I think it's very sensible for us that if you're exponentially expanding, then the selection will mainly be on increasing the birth rate. And if you run out of food, then basically you cannot divide anymore because you just cannot get the material to do it, right? And so your birth rate will go down, and in that regime, it's the guys who can also lower their death rates most that are going to be the ones that are going to survive, right?
Of course, this has been studied in like history theory.
Right. This isn't
evolution of R and K strategies.
Yeah, exactly. This is sort of like a population genetic context of R versus K selection.
So R and K strategies.
Yeah. Well, R is meaning of
growth rate.
Growth. That's okay. You know, where you have expanding population. The K is
and star
capacity. Sometimes you can show, in models that those select for these different judges. What's interesting here is that it's done in the context of, having to be different but saying the ratio is equal so that it's a notion of neutrality.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to study as something like that, like how the betas would change over evolutionary timescales. But I think the initial issue here is just that if you have bugs that aren't going to change much over the time scale of your experiment or your survey, what conclusions can you make about selection based on different ways of looking at the population?
It's not quite a question, it's from a suggestion. Is it possible to include a symmetric cell division in your model? Because if you think about evolution of somatic tissue or evolution of tumor, like this cancer genomics data, which will have an abundance very soon, do we think you can generalize this model to those types of systems?
Asymmetric cell division, meaning?
Asymmetric cell division. So where you have a stem cell, which can divide either symmetrically or asymmetrically, and then you have, say, progression. So it's somatic tissue. Or then if you have a tumor, then you have cancer stem cells, and then obviously tumor progression, which doesn't have necessarily micro exponentially for a very long time. So there's no constant population size.
So when you say asymmetric or symmetric,
asymmetric
means that in one case it.
Populations are symmetric in your model. So even have a stem cell which can either divide symmetrically.
What does it mean to divide asymmetrically first?
Asymmetrically meaning that, for example, I can differentiate. I can.
Okay, fine. Fine. A new type.
Cell,
okay.
Cell would
yeah.
Be
okay. Great. I don't know. I mean, I think you could probably try to include that. It would be a third type of. A source of divisions. It's an interesting idea. There's no differentiation in this model. I'd love to think on that, think about it. I mean, one thing I should mention that you can include here is I've allowed here for the cell to, well, I'm thinking about cells, and so the cell divides and has one offspring or zero. It doesn't divide. And you can actually replace that with an arbitrary distribution of offspring number. And it turns out that the variance of that, just the first two moments of that distribution, actually enter into the SDEs in the same kinds of places that other variances enter. In other words, we can derive all these results where you include variances in offspring number. That's still not actually differentiation.
But in yeast, it's actually been measured. You know, people study replicating lifespan, and it averages 30 buds before that cell just can't bud anymore.
Oh, I'd love to see papers like that. So they took movies then.
Yeah, well, you don't even need movies there because the buds leave scars, and so you can just count how many buds a cell has had in its lifetime.
So 30, that's...
Yeah, what I understand is happening is that there are certain protein complex structures that calls and so on in bacteria, not for yeast cells, but that basically they get messed up at some point and there's no way, there's no program for undoing that. And so once it's messed up, that cell can't divide it.
I think the other basic question is, so in this model, the timing between cell divisions is a Poisson rate. And the first thing I'm going to do when I look at these movies is just ask, are cell division times overdispersed or are they interspersed? I mean, I don't think that that's been studied in enough detail. It's probably extremely important for things like fixation of alleles. Okay.
On the wiki, there is nothing scheduled for tomorrow.